Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The order and the accuracy that is found in the structure of even the smallest unit of this world is the same order found in the structures of its very greatest units. They are all seemingly using one system. It seems that they have had one creator. And as far as we know, man is the most complete and the most sublime being in this material universe. At the same time, we know that with all his lofty reputation, man is confronted many difficulties and he has had many miseries and will have in his short lifetime. When the man is graduated from his infancy with all its difficulties, all its problems and dangers, he comes up against its youth with all its social and psychological storms. And not yet does he gain a foothold in adolescence when old age knocks at the door of his life with all its concomitant miseries. Now, is it possible to believe that the purpose of this great system, the purpose of this man and this miracle of creation, is just to exist for a short time, passing these three periods of life with all these difficulties, all these challenges, and then passing away into nothingness? If this were really the case, wouldn't creation be in vain? Wouldn't creation be useless? Let me ask you this way. Would any wise being create this great system for such a small aim? If you suppose that mankind tarried in this world for millions of years, and millions of generations came and went one by one, and the material sciences advanced so much that man could avail himself to the best nutrition, garments, and dwellings, would eating and drinking and sleeping and all these things be so valuable that they would be the sole purpose of this system? So, the study of this great world is indicating that this life is an introduction to a greater one. It is an introduction to a vaster world which is eternal. It is only the existence of such a world that makes our lives meaningful and purposeful. And consequently, it is not strange that the materialistic philosophers who do not believe in the resurrection and hereafter count this world as vain and aimless. If we did not believe in such a world, we would conquer with them. This is why we say if death were the end of everything, the creation of world would be in vain and purposeless. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shah.
Jahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The President of the Shura Council and the Deputy Speaker of the House of Representatives in the Saudi-backed Hadi regime admitted that the regime has turned its back to Yemeni people and accused the Saudi-led coalition of causing a humanitarian crisis for the whole nation.
The statements by the officials in the Hadi regime clearly show that the war is not the solution to the current problem in Yemen and the country needs a political solution. The statements also reveal the constructive role of the Ansarullah group in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition. There is a growing public call for an end to the war in Yemen.
The Deputy Minister of Information in Sana'a, Nasruddin Amir, said these statements came in the right direction and Sana'a encourages taking such stances against the Saudi-led coalition, even if they do not have a direct impact on the battle.
We welcome any protests within the Saudi-led coalition. These protests show the true nature of the coalition and come in the right direction. We know that this is the U.S. who is leading the war on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 to return their protege, exiled former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, to power. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine.
For 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its announced goals in the beginning of the war. Observers say Riyadh should start looking for other means, including a political solution, to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen, since the Yemeni army has proven that it is now a real threat to the kingdom more than ever. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the winter draws near, relief material starts pouring in for destitute Rohingya refugees in India. But urge for schooling and educational material for their children is their biggest worry. Despite the UN conventions on the rights of child, irrespective of nationality, faith or ethnicity, the majority of Rohingya children continue to be deprived of any formal education, therefore threatening their future.
We have faced all the odds and miseries of this world, but we appeal to the world community not to ignore our generations and do everything possible to help us educate our children.
Several thousand Rohingya Muslims have been camping in parts of India for more than a decade with nothing more to share rather than horrid tales of violent past. In almost all refugee camps, children would usually be seen spending time in dirt and filth, raising fears of disease and infections across the camps. Nevertheless, nobody cares, including them. This man says anxiously, "We will fight with life as long as we can, but the future worry of our children might kill us silently."
We have been living here in peace since the last 9 years. Never faced any troubles. But now things look very challenging. India gave us hope of new life. We want to stay alive for our children, lest we have no hope left.
Regardless of refugee crisis the world has witnessed since last decade, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence, yet ignored or perhaps abandoned. Estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees live in India after fleeing a brutal crackdown in Myanmar. The UN refugee agency responsible to support them is of insignificant help, they say. Rights activists have time and again appealed to the Indian government to lend all possible support to the community, despite the fact they face threat to life back in Myanmar. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh, but it never endorsed any framework to safeguard the interests of these refugees. Now calls are growing for concrete refugee policy, irrespective of political agenda, faith, or ethnicity.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin met with South Korean Minister of Defense Suk Thursday. The two counterparts agreed to develop new operational plans to deal with what Austin described as North Korea's destabilizing behavior.
The United States and the ROK remain committed to a diplomatic approach to the DPRK, and we continue to call upon the DPRK to engage in dialogue. but we also discuss measures to enhance our combined deterrence posture and to defend against the full range of threats.
Missile and nuclear programs. South Korea wants to see sanctions suspended and an official declaration to end the Korean War. Two items apparently not near the top of the military chief's agenda. Meanwhile, outside South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, activists called for Seoul to disentangle itself from an alliance with the U.S. and take control of its own national defense.
South Korean armed forces and military resources are likely to be dragged into U.S. Indo-Pacific strategies. We came here to denounce it and to deliver this message to the American authorities. The U.S. should return wartime operational control immediately.
Austin also called out China over its military buildup, as Washington now plans to move more forces, an attack helicopter squadron, and an artillery division headquarters to be stationed in South Korea.
The meeting here between the leaders of the U.S. and the South Korean militaries comes following the release of the Pentagon's 2021 Global Posture Review. The U.S. will now place even more emphasis on deterring China and North Korea, with Washington calling for more help from its allies. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In draft documents presented to the signatories of the nuclear agreement, Iran is calling for the removal of all U.S. sanctions that violate the deal signed in 2015, known officially as the JCPOA. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani says the Iranian draft includes calls for the removal of all sanctions, especially those imposed under former President Donald Trump, as part of the U.S. maximum pressure campaign.
One of the fundamental issues is that no sanctions that violate the agreements, including those imposed under the Obama, Trump, or Biden administrations, should stay. They're not acceptable. Some of this hadn't been considered in the previous draft. We've included our modifications.
Iran has called for the verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. will not commit further violations. Tehran says the ball is now in the U.S. court.
I think this is beginning to sink in for the Europeans and the Americans, that this administration, the Iranian administration, will abide by the JCPOA, but it will not allow the Americans to get additional concessions. It will not allow the Europeans to get additional concessions. Iran did not appease Trump. It's not going to appease Biden.
Following talks with EU coordinator Enrique Mora on Thursday, Bagheri also met the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Mariano Grossi, expressing Iran's intention to continue its close cooperation with the agency and to remain actively engaged in the Vienna talks.
Iran's lead negotiator says he's warned other participants not to allow outside players to negatively influence or obstruct the process of talks, saying his team is serious about reaching an agreement and is ready to continue negotiations. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Besides financial crisis and political instability, Afghanistan is experiencing one of the worst droughts of the last three decades, further pushing the country into hunger and famine. According to the UN bodies, 80% of Afghans' livelihoods are tied to agriculture, which is now extremely hit by water scarcity and climate change.
This year, we face a severe drought. Farming costs too much for us. The Taliban have deteriorated our situation by adopting certain policies. They receive 5% of our harvest, or a fraction of our income.
I am 84 years old, and over the past 15 years, I have been experiencing a severe drought in my hometown. Farmers are dealing with water scarcity. We used to have four water springs, but today they are all dried up. Meanwhile, we don't have the required facilities to dig deep wells. So, what should we do? Most of us have left our farms, migrating to neighboring countries.
We are suffering from water scarcity. As you see, we don't have anything to harvest this year because of the drought. We hope that the new government and the international community help us amid the current harsh conditions, because we don't have anything to eat.
The Taliban said they are exploring ways to deal with the drought crisis in the country, awaiting help from the international bodies.
There are many farmlands and gardens with most of them left uncultivated because there is no water in wells and rivers. Anyway, we have some plans to overcome the problem. We rely on the international support.
Afghanistan's economy had been rapidly declining since the U.S. seized nearly $10 billion in assets of the Afghan Central Bank. Severe drought combined with aid cut has contributed to pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Here is a remote area in Kabul. Farmers here used to cultivate and grow livestock, but now due to drought, either they're fleeing the country or struggling with acute hunger and poverty. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kalakon District.
As Yemenis celebrate Independence Day, the Aid and Youth Movement called for an uprising against the presence of the Saudi-led coalition's forces and those affiliated with the Hadi regime in the occupied city in southern Yemen.
There is a growing public call for the withdrawal of the invaders from the southern governance because their presence has deteriorated the ordinary people's living condition and the invaders are in full control of the country's oil and mineral wealth. Today, an awakening movement is coming into force, which is against the foreign presence. The movement reminds us of what our ancestors did when they expelled the British occupiers from southern Yemen in 1967.
The movement denounced the deteriorating living condition caused by the continued collapse of the local currency. The U.S. dollar's price has exceeded 1,600 riyals in the occupied areas, compared to 600 riyals in the liberated ones.
The public call for foreign forces withdrawal is completely legitimate because their presence has already led to the current deteriorating condition. It goes without saying that the U.S. and the Saudi-led coalition are the ones who bear the responsibility for these repercussions.
The devaluation of the local currency in the areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces has led to a surge in the prices of basic commodities such as food and medicine. This has hampered daily life for people who are suffering from long years of war.
The depreciation of the local currency and the widespread poverty within the occupied southern areas has contributed to the growing public calls for the foreign forces withdrawal. People here in liberated areas believe that an armed struggle against the invaders is the only way out of the tragic situation in southern regions. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
As more cases of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 are detected in Europe, questions mount over its true origin, how contagious it is, and of course the health threat. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Tuesday.
The thing that's really on everybody's mind is the new variant.
The head of the European Medicines Agency, Eimear Cook, told lawmakers that greater efforts are needed to get more people vaccinated in the EU.
Especially in those member states where the rates are dangerously low. And this is particularly important as we learn more about Omicron.
Even though we know little about the new variant, EU countries are increasing restrictions. Most legislators agree that vaccination rollout remains key.
We were all a bit late in preparing the booster, and it is the biggest problem is, of course, that people don't get the first and second dose.
Citizens have been reacting to the latest developments.
With this new variant, well, I don't know. I mean, the economy is not actually quite strong, I would say, so whether we really balance, like, health, you know, and survival.
From the stock exchange's reaction, it may have a negative impact on our lives again in terms of economy.
One quarter of adults in the EU have still not been jabbed. A contributing factor to hesitancy, it has been suggested, is the refusal of pharmaceutical giants to release vaccine clinical trial data.
This is not just an issue of taxpayers' fund, but also an issue of trust. Trust in the European institution can be built by transparency.
Many EU legislators are saying it's imperative that Omicron serves as a warning. They are again repeating a message they've been trying to send to political leaders now for almost a year. The West must stop hoarding vaccines from poorer nations, otherwise more variants and perhaps more deadly variants will be coming. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
tensions are running high between the United States and China as Washington ramps up pressure against Beijing. The Pentagon says it is planning to improve bases in Guam and Australia to counter what it calls the threat from China. The projects come as part of the U.S. military's Global Poster Review, which calls for prioritizing military construction across the Pacific Islands and additionally military cooperation with allies and partners in the region. Beijing has slammed the plan, accusing the U.S. of creating an imaginary enemy and sparing no efforts to encircle and contain China. It says Washington is using the China threat theory to expand its military presence in the region and serve its hegemonic interests. Since coming to power, President Biden has made China his main foreign policy agenda, with a focus on the Indo-Pacific region. Taiwan has been a major thorn in the deteriorating relations, as Washington has been trying to appease Taipei by arming it. That's despite repeated warnings from Beijing, which views the self-ruled island as part of its territory under the One China principle. The Sino-American standoff is not limited to Taiwan. The two have been at odds over a host of other issues. Beijing has repeatedly accused Washington of interfering in its internal affairs by fueling unrest in the semi-autonomous Chinese city of Hong Kong. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. China and the U.S. are also engaged in a trade war, with both seen imposing tit-for-tat tariffs during the previous U.S. administration. The Sino-American relationship has also deteriorated over a recently inked security pact between the U.S., Australia, and the U.K., known as AUKUS. Beijing says the trilateral partnership, which allows Australia to build nuclear-powered submarines, poses both a regional and global threat. Russian President Vladimir Putin has also accused the AUKUS alliance of fueling regional tensions. Putin's comments come as tensions are also running high between Russia and the West over a series of issues, including Ukraine. The pressure tactic by the U.S. and its allies have driven Moscow and Beijing closer than ever. Earlier this month, they signed a roadmap for closer military ties, citing growing conflict potential and frequent U.S. strategic bomber flights near their borders. Russia and China have realized that the American hegemonic goal, if unchecked, would pose a threat not only to their geostrategic interests, but other countries in the region and beyond.
No kings or queens, but a president from the ranks of Barbadians charting a path forward for the world's youngest republic.
Today, debate and discourse have become action. Today, we set our compass to a new direction, girded by the successes of the last 55 years, buoyed by the confidence garnered from our triumphs and accomplishments.
One of those accomplishments, independence from monarchical rule in 1966, more than three centuries after British settlers arrived and turned the island into a wealthy sugar colony based on the work of hundreds of thousands of African slaves. The UK's Prince Charles, who stood somberly as the new Barbados was declared, had this to say.
From the darkest days of our past and the appalling atrocity of slavery, which forever stains our history, the people of this island forged their path with extraordinary fortitude.
Some experts are saying that Barbados becoming a republic is the natural progression of a trend that started in 1952 when Queen Elizabeth II acceded to the throne. That it will accelerate, not necessarily in this reign, but perhaps in the next.
The brutal history in Barbados and other Caribbean islands has also spurred calls for reparations from the UK. For now, though, this republic of nearly 300,000 will be celebrating throwing off the shackles of British colonialism and focus on building their future Barbadian style. Saeed Puriza, London.
The nations of the English Channel and the European Commission convened in Paris following the deadliest mass drowning on record. The United Kingdom was excluded, a controversial punishment for UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's public tweet asking for joint military patrols and renegotiations of emigration agreements. At the request of London, for the past 3 years, France has blocked all other routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option. Many say that when it comes to refugees, what comes first is political considerations and not humanitarian obligations.
Once again, we're in a French election campaign which wants to scapegoat immigrants for political gain. The three top candidates, including President Emmanuel Macron, are all awful and also on the far right. Therefore, they emphasize falsehoods such as immigrants cost the state too much money, even though every study proves that the state grows fat from the taxes and cheap labor of illegal immigrants.
Primary motivation cited by refugees is to be with family members in the United Kingdom, a neo-colonial power. French officials accused the UK of economically profiting off of quasi-modern slavery by attracting refugees with the lure of not needing papers to work in the UK. Despite being militarily involved in many of the world's top refugee-producing conflicts today, the UK currently hosts around 200,000 of the world's 84 million refugees. Refugees compose just 0.25% of the UK population, while countries like Iran and Lebanon host well over 1 million asylum seekers each. Many note that while Brexit has taken the UK out of the European Union, it has not removed its commitments to international law.
France said the easiest solution is for the United Kingdom to widen its legal route for asylum seekers. Paris has long offered to let British immigration officials process asylum requests on French soil. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Criminalizing Hamas may please the Israeli regime and the right wing of his party, but it will only further blacken Britain's already dark record as the betrayer of the Palestinian people, says Avi Shalem, writer in an article titled "Hamas Terror Listing is Yet Another UK Betrayal of the Palestinians." Stay tuned for more. British Home Secretary Priti Patel has declared her intention to proscribe the whole of Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement that rules the Gaza Strip, as a terrorist organization. The military wing of the group was proscribed in the UK back in March 2001. 20 years on, the Home Secretary proposes to extend this ban to the political wing by arguing that the distinction between the two wings is no longer tenable. The truth of the matter is that the distinction was tenable in 2001 and it is still tenable today. What is more, it is a crucial distinction. Patel's announcement came soon after Benny Gantz, the Zionist regime war minister, designated six Palestinian civil society NGO groups as terrorist organizations. This designation came close on the heels of the decision by the International Criminal Court, ICC, to launch a full-scale investigation of alleged war crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Zionist regime war minister, Benny Gantz, was Israel's forces chief of staff during its assault on Gaza in July 2014, in which at least 2,256 Palestinians were martyred, of whom 1,462 were civilians, including 551 children. This makes Gantz a prime suspect in the ICC's war crimes probe. Hamas agreed to cooperate with the ICC investigation, but the Zionist regime refused. Some of the Palestinian organizations placed on the Zionist regime's terrorist list are cooperating with the ICC investigation. Although the evidence produced by the Israeli regime was judged inadequate by the European Union and the U.S. government, the terrorism labor achieved its goal of stigmatizing the NGOs, curbing their ability to raise funds and disrupting their operations. The Zionist regime's move was widely condemned as an attack on human rights. The British Home Secretary was not among the protesters. Patel shares with UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson a Manichean view of the West Asia region struggle, in which the Zionist regime represents the forces of light and Palestinian Hamas the forces of darkness. The reality is slightly more complicated. Reactions to Patel's announcement were predictably polarized. A Hamas official said that it showed absolute bias towards the Israeli regime occupation and is a submission to Israeli regime blackmail and dictations. He accused the UK of supporting the aggressors at the expense of the victims. The Board of Deputies of British Jews warmly welcomed the move. In the Israeli regime media, the British decision was hailed as a triumph for the Zionist regime's diplomacy. At a deeper level, the shift in British policy was a product of the close ties between the fake regime of Israel and the Conservative Party. The fake regime of Israel and its powerful lobby had been pressing the British government on this issue for some time. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett urged Boris Johnson to outlaw the whole of Hamas when he met with him last month at the UN climate conference in Glasgow. Patel needed no prompting to do the Zionist regime's bidding. In 2017, as Secretary of State for International Development, Patel went on a freelance trip to the occupied territories without informing then Prime Minister Theresa May or Boris Johnson, then Foreign Secretary. While pretending to be on a private holiday, Patel held a series of secret meetings with high-ranking Zionist regime officials, including the then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Lord Polak, president of the Conservative Friends of Israel, personally arranged 12 of these meetings. Upon her return, Patel asked her officials to explore the possibility of diverting some of the foreign aid budget to enable the Zionist regime army to carry out humanitarian work in the occupied Golan Heights. She was forced to resign, and she accepted her actions fell below the high standards that are expected of a Secretary of State. Close contact with Zionist regime officials and lobbyists for Israel in the UK, as well as her own right-wing worldview, left Patel eager to swallow Zionist regime's narrative about Hamas. This narrative is utterly distorted and blatantly self-serving. Here, however, are some of the relevant facts. True friends do not indulge their friends' addiction, but try to win them from it. Boris Johnson could hardly be more indulgent. His partisanship extends to resisting all international attempts to call the Israeli regime to account for its acts of aggression and unlawful behavior. He is opposed, for example, to the International Criminal Court investigation into war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories committed by the fake regime of Israel. In a letter to the Conservative Friends of Israel, he said that while his government had respect for the independence of the court, it opposed this particular inquiry. This investigation gives the impression of being a partial and prejudicial attack on a friend and ally of the UK's, he wrote. The perverse logic of the statement is that being a friend and ally of the UK places the Israeli regime above international law. One final question. Why was the latest anti-Palestinian policy shift announced by the Home Secretary rather than the Foreign Secretary? Peter claims that designating the whole of Hamas as a terrorist organization should be seen through a domestic prism. It will help to protect Jews in this country. This is preposterous. Hamas exercises its right under international law to resist the Israeli regime occupation, the most prolonged and brutal military occupation of modern times. Fear-mongering and criminalizing the political wing of Hamas will not make British Jews any safer. In May, in a massively disproportionate use of force, the fake regime of Israel carried out an aerial bombardment of Gaza that resulted in the death of 256 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Community Security Trust, a charity concerned with the safety and security of Jews in the UK, recorded a horrific surge in racist attacks during that month, which surpassed anything we have seen before. If the British government genuinely wanted to make Jews in this country feel safer, it should stop blaming the Palestinian victims for their own misfortune. It should urge its Israeli ally to respect international humanitarian law, to observe ceasefire agreements, to exercise restraint in the use of military force, and to talk to the political leadership of Hamas. Peitel's latest move only serves to expose the utter bankruptcy of the Conservative government's policy toward Israel-Palestine. The government claims to support a two-state solution to the conflict, yet, despite the repeated parliamentary votes in favor of recognizing Palestine, the government refuses to budge. When he was Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson told the House of Commons that the Conservative government would recognize Palestine when the time was right. But the government he now heads, the time will never be right. Timing is just an excuse to procrastinate while continuing to appease the Zionist regime. To be sure, British recognition of Palestine would not redress the huge asymmetry of power between the two parties, but it would give the Palestinians parity of esteem. This is the least that Britain can do for the Palestinians today, given its long series of betrayals stretching back to the Balfour Declaration over a century ago. In his 2014 book, The Churchill Factor, Johnson wrote that the Balfour Declaration was bizarre, a tragically incoherent document and an exquisite piece of effo fujerma. Today, from his position of power, Johnson has a unique opportunity to rectify an egregious historical wrong. Criminalizing Hamas may please the Zionist regime and the right wing of his party, but it will only further blacken Britain's already dark record as the betrayer of the Palestinian people.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, issues, and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the Holy Book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. We'll continue the previous session's topic of how to probably solve problems we may face when raising our children. Last we spoke of that, first of all, we must diagnose the problem, we must then have self-control when exercising our punishment, and thirdly, the punishment must be a gradual process. Dear Sayyid, please let us pick up where we left off last time.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil faraja. Now we spoke about the art of problem solving, and we said there are a few things need to be taken into consideration when it comes to the art of problem solving. So there are a few things that we did not have the chance to mention them in the previous episodes, so inshallah we'll try to cover them today. When we look at the methods of problem solving, one thing we need to keep in mind is that when it comes to solution and giving medicine to a problem, there are many ways, not just one. For example, sometimes talking to a child might work.
Right.
Sometimes giving him a story to read might do the job. But sometimes it might not do the job. Right? So sometimes you yourself give him an advice, sometimes directly, sometimes you give him advice indirectly. Sometimes you let someone else do it, right? Sometimes you might present your solution in a form of, I don't know, an activity. Sometimes you solve, you give your solution in a form of a play, not in a form of what have you.
Right.
So medicine always, like even now when you go to the doctor, sometimes the doctor gives you a tablet, sometimes he gives you, I don't know, a drink, sometimes
right.
he gives you an IV.
An exercise.
Yeah, sometimes he gives you an injection.
Right.
So as you know, in the same way that medicine itself comes in different forms, because each one would have a different strength, a different way of using it. Same thing with dealing with kids and problems.
Right.
That each problem requires a different type of medicine, and the medicine itself changes. So the solutions to any problem always changes. So this is something that parents that need to keep in mind.
Right.
Don't think there's only one solution to everything, and don't think that the problem itself, it always requires the same solution. Sometimes no. It might require more than one method
right.
of dealing with it. So
right.
keeping your mind open when it comes to trying to solve that problem.
And on that note, dear listeners, we'll be going on a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to solve problems we may face when raising our children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Okay, so previously we were saying that the solution itself changes in the same way that medicine changed. Now, also when it comes to the art of problem solving, one of the important backbone of problem solving is that parents should not despair, should not give up. Because a lot of parents, they expect that a problem that arises in their children to be quickly fixed and out of the way.
Right.
It's not going to be that easy. And I keep saying, it's exactly the same way with the body itself. Sometimes you get a problem, you get sick, you don't get cured in one day. It takes time before you heal. Takes time before you treat it
right.
And you go back
to
it.
It's a process.
Yeah, it's a process that takes time. So if I'm sick and for, you know, over a week I still have a flu and a cold, and I'm like, okay, I give up. That's it. I'm going to throw myself off a cliff.
Lie down and die somewhere.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't want to be sick. It doesn't work. I just have right. to cope with it. You know, I mean, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullahi says, "Imshi bida'ika ma mashabik."
Right.
Walk with your disease as long as you can.
Right.
That's how life works. So when
you suck it up, life
yeah,
is tough.
That's it. So there's not much you can do. You taking the right process to get yourself cured, and but
right.
then the main thing requires a bit of patience, perseverance, and you need to, when you put a solution into place, it takes time. So don't despair, because most parents, they give up very quickly. They don't have this long-lasting
patience. Right.
They give up very quickly. I've seen a lot of parents, they just can't take it. They might even do it for like half an hour or a day,
right,
or
right.
then they break. I'm like, you haven't even started yet.
That's nothing.
You need to give it time. It requires time, especially with children, because children naturally they're arrogant. Naturally they have they have pride and they have so many
right.
things going on. It's not easy dealing with them. So they require a parent who is constantly patient, who is constantly willing to go the whole nine yards, as we say,
right.
who is willing to, keep his cool and what have you, just in order to see this through.
Right.
Otherwise, you're not going to be doing much. And at the end, obviously, all of this, at the end, it will pay off, right? You'll get to a stage and say, Alhamdulillah, yes, it was hard. Yes, I had to go through so much. But at the end, I can see my kids are good. They
right.
reached a good result. Alhamdulillah, they are mu'mineen, they're good believers, they're doing
right.
what Allah wants them to do. And you can feel that bit of comfort in you as you get older, which is what's required anyway. So
right.
when it comes to bringing up children, it's not an easy process, especially in the art of problem solving. If you have a problem and you are solving it, or in the process of solving it, you definitely need to be patient and don't despair, don't give up. You need to keep going and continue. Now, that's one of the most important things that we have to do when it comes to problem solving. Again, when it comes to problem solving, we need to be very aware, first and foremost, that we need to protect ourselves and have countermeasures and have defense mechanism before the problem starts.
And with that, we'll be going on a quick break.
Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam said, "A child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him, and helping him."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to problem solve in a proper manner. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Now, before the break, we were saying that we need to take protective measures before the problem happens.
Right.
Sometimes we end up as parents causing the problem to begin with without realizing. So for those parents who humiliate the kids, or they curse their kids, or I don't know, shout and yell at their kids, right, you know, like something that the
terrorizing parents their kids.
Yeah. No. So just naturally, for example, when a mother or father wants to call their kids, they yell out. Like they yell at them very loudly.
Yeah, right.
And they call them like in a very strong, harsh manner. And sometimes they might add a word and two words to it.
Right.
Now, the child is in his room and you want him to come and do something for you. And you just go like in this manner. Now, the child gets humiliated. Now, that is a beginning of a problem.
Right.
Or many problems, to say the least. So what happens is sometimes I need to prevent these things from happening so I don't fall in the problem itself. So for example, if you know there's a disease and there's a vaccine, so take the vaccine so you don't get that disease, right? So you protect yourself prior. So as parents with these problems that we have with our kids, you can see that most of the time it could have been prevented having the fact that we as parents have taken the proper adequate measures to make sure it does not happen.
Right.
In the first
planning
place.
Ahead, basically.
Yeah, planning ahead. So, for example, parents who are harsh with their kids, right? Extra harshness that results in so many problems, right?
Right. Yeah.
Or,
of course,
overspoiling the child that also causes a lot of problems. Or, for example, comparing children to children and to other people.
Right. Yes.
That also causes a lot of problems. A child who, for example, feels that he has less love, less emotion, less, you know, of these kind of thing, affection.
Right.
Well, obviously, you can have problems. So, for example, with kids who don't feel safe in their own environment, you're going to have problems. And so on and so forth. So even when, if the parents are not present in the house, when the parents are not around, when one of the parents is not in a relationship, you're going to have these issues. You're
right.
going to have many, many problems.
Naturally. Yeah.
Naturally. So all these problems, they can be prevented, and we can take preventive measures if we just make sure that does not happen. Okay? So I don't do these things. I don't overspoil, for example. I don't become over harsh. I don't swear. I don't curse. I don't do these things. And my problems will be a lot less.
Right.
I don't have to deal with much.
But you say that we need to take countermeasures naturally, but what if the parents are not aware that what they are doing is causing a problem? Because you said yourself they are doing it without themselves being aware of the problem.
That's exactly why me and you are here.
We're talking about
the ways a parent could be the best educator or best parent when it comes. So we're giving them these tips. If they don't know it, then they have to learn. I think one of the things
that
we spoke about before, if you remember, we said that parents need to learn.
Right, of course.
So obviously there is,
right.
You know, we can't say, well, he doesn't know, I don't know. You need to go learn. Even Allah,
right.
I think on Day of Judgment, in the hadith says, when we say to Allah, oh Allah, I did not know.
We didn't know.
And Allah says, Ala ta'allamt? Didn't you go learn? Why didn't you go learn? That's not an excuse you can give me. You had the power, you had the chance.
Right. You have plenty of opportunity,
exactly.
But you didn't go learn.
Exactly.
And with that sobering thought, dear Sayyid, we will have to end today's program. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time and for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If the dear listeners have any questions or other relevant comments and feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, parstoday.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media accounts we have on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture. At the height of the Cold War, the CIA launches a highly classified, top secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. Now, these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16th, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village